Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Is It Normal? The Pregnancy Podcast with me, Jessie Ware. This is a special episode about pregnancy loss. I know so far this series has focused on my pregnancy journey and different aspects of being pregnant and giving birth, but we felt it was incredibly important to do an episode about miscarriage as it happens so frequently. A little later in this episode, I'll be joined by my good friend Alice Haig, who's going to tell us her story about her miscarriage. But first, I'm joined by consultant obstetrician Tejal Amin, who specialises in early pregnancy and miscarriage. Thank you so much for joining us on Is It Normal?
Thank you, Jessie, for having me.
People that are listening to this episode may be potentially miscarrying as we speak, maybe incredibly nervous about it, maybe their first pregnancy, all those people that are Googling constantly for signs of miscarriage. Could we please start with, what are the causes of miscarriage? Is that too hard to explain because there are too many causes of miscarriage?
So there are lots of risk factors that can increase your risk of having a miscarriage, which can then lead on to different causes as well. I mean, it is quite broad in terms of, there are specific things for first trimester. There are other things for recurrent miscarriage that we then look into. And there's things for second trimester miscarriages as well. So I'm happy to go through each one of them. But what I could sort of say is that, you know, the most common cause for first trimester miscarriages is a sporadic chromosomal abnormality. It's not something that you can predict. It's not something that you can prevent. And it's probably something that you don't know about at all. But the chance of that happening again is really low the next time round. So the chance of you conceiving, having another pregnancy are very, very good. So that's the most common reason why when people present to the early pregnancy unit and we diagnose a miscarriage, it's usually because of chromosome abnormality. There are other risk factors that we have in our lives that we can modify. So there are lifestyle modifications that do increase your risk of having a miscarriage. So things like smoking, alcohol intake during the pregnancy. Obviously, drug taking, all of that can increase your risk of unfortunately having a miscarriage as well. And then, you know, a lot of the times there are things that you just can't change. And unfortunately, age is one of them. Mm. You know, and it's heartbreaking that your risk of miscarriage goes up as we get older. So when you're in your 20s, the chance of having a miscarriage is about, you know, 11%. So it's low.
Right.
But as you get older, with each decade of your life, it gets significantly higher. So those in their 40s have the highest chance of miscarriage. And we're sort of looking around 65, 70% of having a miscarriage at that sort of age.
Do you have a percentage for the rate of second trimester miscarriages? That's far more rare, right?
Yeah, definitely it is. And actually, the rate of a second trimester miscarriage is about 1% to 2%. So it's much lower than a first trimester miscarriage. And the causes for a second trimester miscarriage are slightly different to first trimester miscarriages. So, you know, things like age or underlying medical conditions, they all are still factors, but there are other factors that can also potentially lead to a second trimester miscarrages. So just briefly, sort of one of them is like cervical weakness. So if the cervix is a little bit weaker, so anyone who may have had treatment on their cervix for an abnormal smear test, so like a Letts procedure and things, they often will get referred to what's called a preterm birth clinic. So they can have cervical length monitoring. So they can just measure the lengths of the cervix throughout their pregnancy from, you know, usually starting for about 12 weeks onwards. You know, if it starts shortening, you see signs of it shortening, you can then intervene. But that is one of the sort of one of the risks. Another one that, you know, often people ask is about food poisoning. Will that lead to a miscarriage?
Yeah.
So it's difficult because it depends on, you know, what the underlying cause for the food poisoning are. We know that there are certain foods in pregnancy that just you shouldn't be eating. So things like blue cheeses or unpasteurized cheese or unpasteurized dairy products, there's a higher risk of having a bacteria called Listeria. So that can contribute to second trimester miscarriages as well. Also, same thing with, like, you know, raw, uncooked meats. You can have various bugs in that called toxoplasmosis that can lead to a miscarriage as well. And also, you know, partially cooked or raw eggs, we will say avoid that as well because of the risk of salmonella.
You know, some people may not know about the early pregnancy unit that much. They may have done a pregnancy test at home. They may have seen their GP. Can you explain what this area is and what you kind of you deal with in this unit and this area of the hospital?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the early pregnancy units that I work in are very sort of doctor and nurse led together. So we all work together as a big team in terms of looking after patients who are coming in. People might come in saying that they've had a bit of nausea, a bit of vomiting, they're a bit worried, so they come over to get checked out. You know, often we want to confirm that the pregnancy is in the right place, find out there's a reason why they're having nausea and vomiting in their pregnancy. So is it a twin pregnancy? There are other things that can cause sort of severe morning sickness, such as like molar pregnancies as well. So that's another reason why we'd want to do a scan to find out, make sure that that's not a potential cause for the nausea and vomiting. Other times, most commonly, we have women presenting either with a bit of pain, bleeding as well. And that can range anything between a spot of blood to quite heavy bleeding as well. So we always, you know, we'll see people, we'll make sure we check them over, make sure that they're well in themselves as well as assessing the pregnancy. So they're the sort of things that we'll often see in our early pregnancy unit.
And let's talk about spotting and the difference between spotting and serious bleeding. When should somebody be potentially coming into the early pregnancy unit? What is classified as more than spotting? I mean, because lots of people spot in their pregnancies, right? That's like implantation, and that can be. So what signs are we looking for?
So bleeding, I'll say, is quite a common occurrence. It can happen, but you shouldn't ignore it. Uh-huh. So if you have had, even if it's a bit of spotting and you're worried about it, then, you know, we have early pregnancy units all across the country. So you can attend your local early pregnancy unit. Sometimes you have to call up first of all, because not all of them may be walk-in services, or you have to be referred by your GP. So that's important just to be aware of what your local hospital may have, their policies may well be. But I think, you know, anytime that you have, even if it is a bit of spotting, if you haven't had a scan in the early pregnancy to confirm, first of all, that the pregnancy is in the right place, because that's really important. So, you know, you can get bleeding with a pregnancy that's not growing in the correct place.
So, is that an ectopic pregnancy?
Exactly. So it's important not to ignore those sorts of symptoms. So one, it will give you hopefully reassurance that your pregnancy is in the correct place, and hopefully that it's progressing, you know, as it should be. But if it isn't, then at least you're in the services, you know, you'll be followed up, you have that support as well. So sort of going back to saying, you know, like, what should you look out for? What's safe to ignore? I don't think it's ever safe to ignore any kind of bleeding, really, ever, or even the pain. So, which is why I think you should always get yourself checked out, get your scan done as well, know that your pregnancy is in the right place. And then you'll always be given advice by the person who's seeing you. So, you know, they might say, look, there's a reason for your bleeding. You know, you might have what's called a hematoma. So it's like a small collection of blood that's next to the pregnancy inside the womb that's just slowly discharging. So then, you know, at least then you know what to expect. You might continue bleeding, and if it then gets a lot heavier, that's a reason for you to go in and seek sort of medical advice. I'd also say that, you know, if you've got bleeding and it's making you feel unwell, always go in and, you know, come to the hospital so that we can check you over. Don't ignore these things.
Is there anything you can do to prevent a miscarriage?
Sadly not. Lots of different, you know, like research groups and things like that have really tried looking into, say, is there anything that we can do to try and prevent it? And unfortunately, at the moment, the answer is no. There are things that have shown that may help in pregnancy. So actually, like, one of the things in the United Kingdom that's happened is that our guidelines have changed very, very recently in terms of offering women something called progesterone tablets. So lots of our, you know, listeners may have heard about this and wondering, you know, whether they can and can't get it. So at the moment, the guidelines that have come from, you know, sort of much bigger bodies and things that we don't have control over at the moment have said that if you've had a previous miscarriage and then in this pregnancy you've got some bleeding and you've had a scan to confirm that the pregnancy is in the right place, you'll be offered progesterone support, so suppositories, up until about 16 weeks, because there was a study that was performed a couple of years ago that showed in the recurrent miscarriage populations, in the women who've had multiple pregnancy losses, that that may be a benefit. So that's one of the new things that's sort of coming up. But all the time, you know, doctors and scientists and everyone, we're all looking into sort of finding out, are there things that might help try and reduce the risk or try and prevent? But at the moment, there really isn't at the moment.
Talking about multiple miscarriages there, why might some people be more prone to multiple miscarriages than others? You know, we've talked about age being a higher risk of miscarriage, but are there any other issues that could affect people that potentially are in, you know, 20s, 30s?
Yeah, there are. So again, here in the United Kingdom, you know, we only really start investigating to find out if there's an underlying condition that's contributing to the recurrent pregnancy losses, the recurrent miscarriages. If you've had three or more, and they say consecutive as well, that's when you get referred to a specialist recurrent miscarriage clinic where they can do other tests to find out why that might be. So one of the causes for recurrent miscarriages is something called antiphospholipid syndrome. So it's got a long name, but what it basically means is that you're carrying certain antibodies in you that tend to make your blood more sticky, so you're more likely to clot. But you've also then had what we call an adverse pregnancy outcome. So something like the miscarriages, or you've had a baby where it has been born very early on, so preterm birth, and also any sort of miscarriage after 10 weeks as well. So if you've had a late miscarriage too. So these are all classified as adverse pregnancy outcomes. And so that's actually something that can be treated, you know, with things like aspirin and heparin once you then fall pregnant. So that's one of the potential causes. Another one is having what we call inherited thrombophilia. So again, so this is something that, you know, you may not know about, or you might know about if you've had a clot in your lung or your leg before in the past. Mm. And again, you know, we can give medication to try and reduce your risk of clotting. So that also may help as well. And then one of the other things that we always do whenever we're performing ultrasound scans on any of our patients coming in is that we always check to see the shape of the womb. So sometimes the shape of the womb can contribute to these recurrent pregnancy losses. So there's different types of, you know, your womb can be also different types of shapes. So there's something like a heart-shaped one where, you know, you've got a dimple going into it, and that potentially can, you know, cause miscarriages. Whether treating it or not will improve your pregnancy outcome is something that is really debatable, and there really isn't current enough evidence for at the moment for us to say that one is better than the other at the moment. So, I mean, these are the things that, you know, can definitely contribute to recurrent miscarriages.
I wanted to know whether you had any statistics. I think, you know, potentially people that are listening to this may be on their first or second miscarriage, and it's deeply upsetting and traumatic for them. But how common are miscarriages in people in those first 12 weeks? Have you got a stat for that?
Yeah, so miscarriage generally, unfortunately, is really common. You know, sort of one in four women can have a miscarriage at any point in their reproductive life. Right. So it is something that we deal with a lot. And it, you know, it is, it's heartbreaking. You know, every woman that comes in through the department, unfortunately, we're having to tell them that their pregnancy isn't continuing as it should be. It is, it's awful for us, it's awful for them. And, you know, we're always here to support someone through their journey and through their next journey as well. The chance of you, though, having another miscarriage is not like 50% higher. It's not that right at all. You know, the chance of you getting pregnant, having a normal pregnancy the next time around is very, very good. It's only when you have consecutive miscarriages, then that risk increases. But overall in the population, if we look at women who've had, say, one miscarriage, overall, it would be on average about 11%. Two miscarriages, it's about 2%. So those people who are having more than three miscarriages is less than 1%, actually. So they count for a small number, but it's something that still unfortunately can happen.
Can I ask you what support there is for people that are either facing their first miscarriage or multiple? Because I presume that you probably do have support network for them there.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got your team that you go and see, you know, the nurses, the doctors, anyone that you see when you go into the early pregnancy unit, we're always going to be supporting you as well. But if you need extra support, there are other organisations that can definitely support. So within our hospitals, often we have bereavement teams as well. So depending on where in the pregnancy you may have lost the pregnancy at that stage, we have different bereavement teams that can come and support you as well. There are some fantastic charities out there who are doing some really, really good work. So just to sort of name some of them that I'm familiar with and that I've worked with as well. So there's the Tommy's Miscarriage Trust as well. So they're, you know, they not only are doing research and looking into sort of different causes for pregnancy loss, but also they have a bereavement and support network as well that you're free to access. And they've got a fantastic, very easy to use website that you can go on. They'll have a bereavement midwife and a telephone number that you can call as well. So that's one group. There's the Miscarriage Association as well. They have a lot of information and support as well that, you know, that you can go to. And there's another charity as well that I've worked with quite closely in one of the trusts that I used to work with called Cradle. So actually they provide bags that when you're in hospital, if you're having management for your miscarriage in hospital, they provide you with some toiletries and things like that, you know, just comforts that you may have not thought to bring in, or that you've run out, or that you don't really want to go and ask someone to go and get for you. And also they do provide psychological support and counselling, and they can help try and fast track you if you need that extra support as well. There are lots of different organisations out there. There's Relate as well. So people often say, you know, oh, but I think that's only for, like, say, couples counselling or something like that. They do provide counselling as well for anyone who's had a miscarriage or a pregnancy lost at any point, because it's not just also having a miscarriage, it's sometimes it's also the fact that you may have had a pregnancy but then just you couldn't see it, so it was a pregnancy of unknown location. That's still a pregnancy loss at the, you know, at the end of the day, like, you, it hasn't turned out the way you thought it was going to be. And it's really important that, you know, if we need that help, we need that support, we try and access it, and always talk to your, you know, to your doctor or your nurse that you're seeing, because they'll be able to also help sort of either support you, give you more information that may be of comfort to, but also signpost other places that you may work for you as well.
If somebody has been told at the early pregnancy unit that their pregnancy is non-viable, sadly, you are going to miscarry, can you take our listeners through the next steps? Because I think that is something that potentially is quite a long process. It can be. So can you tell us kind of what a listener should expect, what the kind of next few weeks will look like for them?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an individual thing and it really varies from person to person. But overall, when we give that news in the clinic that unfortunately the pregnancy is not continuing and we've confirmed that it's a miscarriage, at that stage, often what we'll ask is whether they want us to go through what the options are in terms of how to manage things. Sometimes people don't want to talk about it at that stage, which is absolutely fine. You know, you don't have to make any decisions at that point. Sometimes just absorbing that news, that information, and you just want to leave the department, that is a completely normal way to feel as well. And, you know, and that's fine. If that's the case, then we always give you our telephone numbers and say, get back in touch when you're ready, come back and see us and we'll go through things then. But if at that point we are discussing, you know, what the options are, then, I mean, essentially just broadly, there are three options that women can choose as to sort of what they want to do for their miscarriage. They will vary slightly depending on the stage of your pregnancy. So like how far gone you are, whether there's any other risk factors as well, like your medical conditions and things like that, that might influence one over the other. But if I'm just sort of speaking broadly about those, the three different options. So one would be what we call expectant management. So you let nature take its course, it's watching and waiting. A lot of the times, if the bleeding has already begun, it's a sign that, you know, the body's recognized that things are not developing as they should be. And it's its own way of treating the miscarriage, essentially. So if you decide that, you know, you want to just watch and wait, we normally give you a sort of a 2-week window period to see if everything happens in that stage. So normally what we explain is that there'll be heavy bleeding. So the way we often quantify bleeding is related to a period. So, you know, it will be heavier than what a period is like. So if you ever feel unwell, you just can't cope with that amount of bleeding, come into the hospital, we'll look after you. So, you know, don't feel like you have to go through it at home, because it is quite scary to see that at home, not just for you, but also for your family that may be around you, or friends, or anyone who may be supporting you through it. Or if you may not have anyone to support you through it at home as well, then, you know, if you need to be in hospital, come in, don't be by yourself.
What about pain relief for that? Because, you know, you can get really bad cramps, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes it's more than just cramps. It can be really severe pain where, you know, people are doubled over. So we always say you can take whatever painkillers you've got at home and what works for you normally. Uh-huh. Things like paracetamol is fine, ibuprofen. If you have something like codeine that works for you, but it can make you feel a bit sick and a bit drowsy, you can take that. But obviously, you know, there's a maximum dose of each tablet that you can take. So if it's just not touching anything and it's really not working, again, that's a sign of that you probably should come into the hospital. So, you know, we can just check you over and see whether you need actually stronger painkillers in hospital if you're not able to sort of manage with that. The other thing that I always say is actually start taking the painkillers before the pain gets really bad. So the minute you start feeling any kind of cramping, some niggles, those sorts of symptoms is when you probably should take some painkillers, maybe take paracetamol. And then as the pain potentially gets more intense, you can then take, say, ibuprofen if you're able to take it, or the next dose of paracetamol if it's time to take the next dose. Don't wait until it's really bad and then start taking the painkillers, because it just takes time for it to sort of, you know, to get on top of things.
And so if somebody isn't going to let it run its course and do it the natural way, some people may not want that option. What is the other option? Is it a surgical approach?
Then there are two other options. One is medication. So it's called medical management. So that's where we give you tablets to essentially just start things off, start the whole process off. But the symptoms and the things that you'll experience are the same as if you were just watching and waiting. So in terms of the pain, the bleeding,
it's not intensified by taking a pill, the pain.
So, it may just come on more quickly. Whereas if you're waiting for nature to take its course, yes, you know, there might be a slight gradual buildup and then it starts. Whereas with the tablets, you may not really have many symptoms and then all of a sudden you start bleeding, or sometimes you don't really get much bleeding at all, in which case you have to have another dose or you have to have another sort of type of treatment for it. So it doesn't always work, but it is an option that, you know, that is definitely available. And then the third option is to have a surgical procedure. So lots of hospitals will either do it with you. You can be awake if you really don't want a general anaesthetic. We can do these things awake. We give some local anaesthetic to numb the cervix. And there's usually several people in the room. So you have, you know, the person who's doing the procedure, you usually have somebody scanning at the same time as well. And usually another sort of like a healthcare assistant or somebody there just, you know, as a support, like come and hold your hand. So that's one option. Or the other option is to be asleep and have a general anaesthetic and essentially it's a suction procedure. So same as the one that when you're awake as well. And we use sort of very small suction tubes just to clean everything out inside.
I wanted to know when, you know, people that have miscarried or are miscarrying, they may want to try for a baby quite quickly after. When can you try for another baby?
Our advice normally is just to wait to have one period and then you can start trying again. But really, you should start trying, you know, when you feel emotionally and physically ready as well. So the bare minimum we say is like wait for a normal period, just because your ovulation might be sort of a little bit out of sync as what it may normally. So you might ovulate a bit later, a bit earlier than you would normally. But it also gives us a chance to figure out roughly how many weeks you might be if you've had one normal period and then you get pregnant again. And actually, all the evidence out there says that you're quite fertile after a miscarriage. So, you know, there's no reason, you know, before people say, oh, you wait 6 months, that you don't need to. If you feel physically ready, emotionally ready, and you want to try, I would always say just wait for your period and then start trying again. Make sure you're taking your folic acid and all your prenatal vitamins as well. You know, I often say, like, there's no reason to stop them. You can just carry on. They've got all the vitamins that you need anyway. So it's a good supplement to take anyway. So just carry on taking those. And then when you feel ready, you can start trying again.
Thank you so much for joining us on Is It Normal? Thank you for informing us all about different areas of miscarriage. I think it'll be really, really helpful for all our listeners listening to this episode. Thank you.
No, thank you.
So now we are going to speak to my best mate, Alice, who has had quite the journey in conceiving and miscarriages. And so it felt only right to invite her in to have this conversation, which is going to be hard, I think, for people to listen to, but also hopefully optimistic and that there has been some really amazing outcomes. Alice, thank you for joining us on Is It Normal?
Thank you, Jess.
we've talked about having babies since we were teenagers. It's been an obsession of ours, right? And I had a baby before you. I had my first before you. And then can you tell us about when you started trying and what that process was like for you?
I think the point you make at the beginning is actually really is part of the story, in that I never for 1 minute thought that I would have a problem conceiving. And whether that's like really naive or smug or what, but I just didn't think it would be an issue for me.
Your mum has 5 children.
Yep, I'm one of 5 kids. And I don't know, I just think, and it was the same when I finally did have a baby, just, you know, spoiler alert, I have got a child, that when they were talking about cesareans and things like that, I just thought, oh, it's not going to be me. I'm going to be one of those earth mothers who just, you know, pushes her out in like a few pops. But it just, it was not easy for me from the beginning. So I got pregnant really quickly when I first started trying, and we were so excited. And then within probably about a week, I started bleeding, and I went to the early pregnancy unit, and they couldn't see anything, but it was quite early, so they weren't sure. And then by the end of that week, it was much heavier bleeding, and I was miscarrying. And to be completely honest, in a sense, it wasn't the most traumatic thing. It was a miscarriage in the way that sometimes they're described as kind of a heavy period. And because I was so early in the journey of trying, it was actually, I don't know, I felt positive that I got pregnant. I felt like I was in the gang of people getting pregnant and doing this like grown-up thing, and I wasn't in pain, and it was so early on that it just didn't feel, I wasn't gutted. I was really like sad and disappointed, but I was okay. So that was the first miscarriage. And then I had a really long period of trying and trying and trying
how long?
So that was 18 months.
From when you last conceived?
Yeah. Okay. So by that stage, we'd started to have tests about what was going wrong, whether there was something wrong with my husband or I. And anybody who's been through infertility and trying for a baby, it is the most difficult and crushing disappointment every month. You'd think maybe you would get used to it, but you don't. And every month there's hope, and every month there's excitement, and then every month, you know, you get to the point where your period comes and you feel angry, and that it's unfair, and that everybody else is pregnant, and everybody always is pregnant when you're trying. But we carried on, and you know, that was, it's tough on your relationship as well. Like, it, somebody once said to me during it, it hits you really hard at the place where relationships usually find solace. So like, you know, intimacy and sex and all of that stuff is usually the place where, when it's really hard, you...
Stakes are high.
Yeah.
It's stressful.
Yeah. And when that's taken away from you as a kind of comfort or a, a making up thing or whatever, that's really tricky and really difficult. So anyway, we had this 18 months of difficulty.
Did you miscarry within those 18 months?
No. No miscarriages,
just
no pregnancies.
Didn't
just didn't get pregnant, as far as I know.
Did the tests tell you anything?
No, we had this unexplained, so every test came back completely normal, and we were just basically playing a waiting game, because once you get to 2 years, then you are eligible for fertility treatment.
In the UK, is that how it is?
That's how it is in the UK. So, you know, you start the ball rolling at 1 year, you start having all the tests just to see what might be going on, and then you kind of are waiting. So I strangely hadn't given up hope that I would get pregnant, I think because of that early pregnancy that didn't work out. And then this one day, my period was due, and it was so regular, and it didn't arrive. And I thought, oh my God, this actually happened. I'm so like gobsmacked. So then the next day went along, no period, no period, no period. Then a little bit of spotting, and that went away. I was like, oh my God, I'm pregnant. And then I took a test and I was pregnant, couldn't believe it. And this had been now like 10 days since my period was late. And then unfortunately, a couple of weeks later, I started to spot again. And this time it developed, and it was completely different to the first miscarriage.
So,
well, firstly, it was incredibly painful. Now that I've gone through labour, that's how it felt. So it was like that kind of band of contraction around your body. And the bleeding was really heavy. And to be honest, the worst bit was the emotional side of it, because it wasn't like when I'd only been trying for 4 weeks. It was, I'd been trying for now nearly 2 years. And I was just like completely crushed. Couldn't believe the luck of having another one, you know, having all that time in between, and then I get pregnant and then it's another one. And I was just, I'm absolutely devastated. And I'm really keen to highlight the difference between the two miscarriages, just because I think sometimes you feel, when you've had early miscarriages particularly, like they're not valid, or that they're not quite as bad as, you know, awful miscarriages when you miscarry much later. But actually, I think it's much more to do with where you are in your life and what the situation is. So two miscarriages at not massively different times in the pregnancy were physically completely different. And they're full on physically, but also just emotionally and mentally were totally different. Anyway, fast forward, that happened, and that was really, really tough.
And in the meantime, I got pregnant with my second.
Yes.
And I have to say, you never showed any resentment, and I'm sure it was hard. I felt uncomfortable telling you. I felt very guilty, and this is not my story, but I just want to ask you about, you know, you talked about friends getting pregnant around you. Mm. How hard was that for you, and how people spoke to you? How did that make you feel? And did you feel there was a tone that people were giving you, an apologetic tone? I mean, how did it feel for you? Because you were still trying.
Yeah, it's really, really hard, because someone very close to me is going through it at the moment, and I am currently pregnant. So this is my second, yeah. And I had to tell this person who's very close to me that I was pregnant. And I decided to, which is not the way we normally communicate, to do it via message, via WhatsApp or text or whatever it was.
Why?
Because of that exact thing you're talking about, that there's something in being told face to face where you have to arrange your face. Mm. And so you get the news and all you want is to be pleased for someone, because you are, essentially, you love them, you're pleased for them. You don't begrudge them, and it's not your journey. Their life isn't your life. However, you can't help but feel the kind of lump and the feeling of like, when is it going to be me? Mm. So I don't know if anybody is in that position. I mean, different people will have different ways they want to deal with it, but I would have rather heard, I think, via message, so I could just collect my thoughts, start to feel excited for the person, and then be able to deal with it once I kind of processed it myself.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I mean, this is when we're talking about you trying to conceive.
Mm.
Is there any way that people should speak to you when you've had a pregnancy loss? Because I can understand that, you know, for people that haven't experienced that ever, the tone and nuance and sensitivity is really important. You know, what are some of the things that people shouldn't say to you or you didn't particularly appreciate when you'd suffered losses?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, at least you can know you can get pregnant is a really not useful one.
Yeah, okay.
Because it just, it's not the point. And that second miscarriage particularly, I had made a relationship with that baby, yeah. embryo, fetus, whatever, yeah. whatever you want to call it. And so I found those kind of comments really difficult. I think the whole language around it is interesting, and there's lots of discussions about what the right words are, and some people prefer pregnancy loss, some people prefer baby loss, so they identify the baby as a baby, and then miscarriage, I actually don't mind miscarriage, but I know some people feel it sounds a bit sort of careless, like you sort of miscarried it and just dropped it kind of thing. And another thing I think is that it's not a one-off. I think sometimes when you say I've had a miscarriage, it sounds like you went to the toilet and like plop, then it's done. And actually it's a really quite a long process. And obviously the hormones in your body stay a long time. Some people, if they have a miscarriage later on, have all the things that you would have after labour. So they have all those kind of hormonal shifts, the hair coming out and things like that, that you just don't even really, you don't think about when you just think, oh, it's finished, it's done.
And they can go on for quite a long time, right?
Totally.
I mean, how long did your second miscarriage
The second miscarriage was a good few weeks of
just a constant bleeding reminder.
Yeah, exactly. Constant reminder. And there are some instances where you have to have, you know, surgical help to fully get rid of everything, because it's, yeah, it's, there's a lot that's gone on in there in that short time.
Is that a DNC?
Yeah.
Did you have a procedure like that?
I didn't have a procedure like that. I've been fortunate within the unfortunateness to always have had miscarriages that have kind of completed by themselves. I do know friends who have had that, and I think it's really, from what I've heard from them, it's really important to fully research all the different ways that you can be helped in that way, because it can be quite surgical.
How many weeks pregnant were you for the first loss?
So the first loss, I was about 5 weeks pregnant.
Okay.
Yeah.
Second loss?
I think about 7 weeks pregnant.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, not a huge difference between, and yet the gulf so between much, the experience was huge.
So what happened? You kept on trying.
So after the second miscarriage, we had, I mean, when I say took a break, I was trying for a baby and I was obsessed by this stage.
And so, what does that entail? Like your obsession? Was it apps?
Oh my God. Googling
everything. Checking discharge.
Literally like speck of blood in discharge on day 33 of cycle. Pregnant? You know, like just everything. Toe sore when I got out of the bath. Pregnant? And you can find something for everything as well, so it's great. It's great comfort. No, I really I should have really been much more disciplined about Googling, but I wasn't. But yeah, obsessed. Just it completely consumed my everyday thoughts. I couldn't think about anything else.
How did that affect your relationship?
It was really, really tough, because also my husband really wanted a baby as well. So, and I think sometimes they're a bit sidelined in the experience, but as I said before, like I think just the way it affects your relationship is it takes a lot of joy out of intimacy and all the things that you might enjoy together. It really takes that away. And even when you like go away for a break or something, you know, like your husband knows that you've booked it for the exact days of the like, you know, so it's quite, it's tricky. The whole trying for a baby is a real, I think if it doesn't work for you easily, it's a real trauma and really difficult.
So did you get to the 2 year mark?
Yeah. Got to 2 years without a live baby.
Yeah.
And then my IVF came through for my first round, first and only round on the NHS.
Yes. Can you explain or clarify as much as you can? Am I right in thinking different boroughs have different allowances of how many times you can try?
So the NICE guidelines are that there should be 3 rounds,
right?
But due to funding and choices of funding and what people want to spend the money on within different hospitals, different boroughs have different amounts. So my borough had 1 round on the NHS. Thank goodness I didn't know that. This is the kind of thing that you're not told when
yeah
it's really crazy. Like I
Thank goodness that you didn't know this? Because you think you would have been more stressed out?
I would have approached the IVF as an all or nothing. And I don't earn loads of money. So paying for the next round would be really, really tricky.
How much are we talking?
Well, it depends on where you go. But I think between £5,000 and £10,000 per round, and five is quite low.
But you found a charity through listening to a podcast, right?
Yeah, through listening to Big Fat Negative podcast, which is a great podcast if you're going through infertility. Yeah. I listened to a woman who ran a really great fertility clinic called Create, and she was just really inspiring. She wanted to do things really naturally, and she'd set up a sideline clinic, which was sort of shoe, I think they call it like one size fits all shoebox medicine or something, where basically they can do it more affordably because they offer every patient the same thing. So if you have any complications or specific things that you would need within your round of IVF, you wouldn't be eligible. But if you were kind of bog standard, don't know why you can't get pregnant, but you can't, then you would fit it. And so that was an option once our round of IVF hadn't worked.
Did you do IVF or did you do the... there's two forms, isn't there?
Yeah, I did. So there's IVF and there's ICSI and there's IUI. So IUI is when you have the sperm basically inseminated into your womb and then it's like a natural process. Right. But you might have had your eggs pumped up a little bit or your egg pumped up a little bit.
When you say eggs pumped up, that this is you taking hormones and injecting yourself every day.
Yeah. So I had IVF where, yeah, you basically take injections every day to pump up your eggs and to get as many eggs as possible. And then you take another drug to stop you ovulating because you don't want to ovulate until they're ready. And then you take another drug to trigger the ovulation. When they've looked and scanned and they think it looks ready, yeah, you get another injection.
And you're doing all of this at home with the guidance
of the nurses.
But this is you doing it all.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's quite full on. But when you're sort of at what feels like the end of a journey, even though it's actually the beginning of another one, but when you're at the end of a journey like infertility, there's so much excitement that's built up in IVF. There's nerves and there's worry and injecting yourself isn't very nice. And I got this thing called kissing ovaries, where basically my ovaries got so big that they touched each other.
I mean, that's a nice way of putting it,
yeah,
I guess.
I know. But it felt like I had a football in my stomach. It was
so
really...
it's not a good thing.
I mean, I think it sometimes happens anatomically. They get really big, but it was really uncomfortable, yeah. Anyway, the round went well. I got 11 eggs or something like that. And we were buzzing. And then lots of them got fertilized when they went in the little Petri dish with the sperm. So that was great. Buzzing. And then we had transfer day, and by transfer day we probably had one that was good. The others they were going to watch but probably wouldn't be good enough to freeze. So having gone from having quite a lot of hope, you're starting to dwindle a little bit, but you've got the one.
And
for anyone who's been through that process of transferring, it's the most amazing thing because you watch what no one else can watch. Yeah. So there's real positives to it. Like you watch the fertilized thing go in with this sort of solution. They sort of squirt it through a tube and you watch it go into your womb. So you can see this like shooting star of...
You see this baby.
Yeah, your potential baby.
Potential baby inside you that you've created and had a little help.
Yeah, amazing.
So what happened with that
so
baby?
Then you sort of... It's a bit weird because you have it squirted in and then you sort of get up and go and it feels a bit weird, like it
so
might
you're like,
fall
am
out
I pregnant? Or...
yeah. And am I pregnant? Like, what is going on? And you need a wee so much before the procedure, you have to have the fullest bladder. So you go for a wee and you think, oh my God, imagine if it's just come out in the loo. Oh my God. So you're just panicking basically. And then you've got this 2 week wait where you're waiting to see if it worked. And that is now sort of heading towards probably the lowest day of this whole journey. Was the day when I took the pregnancy test and it was negative. I was just like, oh my God, I cannot believe it hasn't worked. And you say all the right things, you say like, oh, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But when it didn't work, I was just, I remember throwing the pregnancy test across the room and just being like, I can't deal with any more disappointment. And then you do deal with it, obviously. You just sort of carry on.
That felt like a loss. Did it feel the same as a miscarriage?
In some ways it felt emotionally very similar. Yeah,
right.
It really was actually very similar. Physically it wasn't, because there wasn't any of the kind of side effects or pain. Right. at that stage. But emotionally, it did feel like that.
He must have just been so tired.
So fed up and tired. And also then I found out that it was only one round. So although I'm glad I didn't know before, then the after effects, that was like, whoa. So we looked into moving to Camden, where they do three rounds, and looked into loads of different things, looked into moving back to where my husband's from, because they have more rounds there. We looked at everything, and we gave ourselves, you know, a month and a half off.
How was your relationship at this time after the IVF, failed IVF?
It was actually a really nice point, because I think both of us were so sad, and actually we were really good support to each other, and we were so disappointed. We just totally got where each other were. And so that felt really good. What I would say is that I didn't share it with people until it was over. Although I shared it with you and a few close friends, but I didn't share it with family because I found the expectation too much.
Too much pressure.
But now, looking back, I think I probably would have shared it more similarly with pregnancy before 12 weeks. I think I can see why it's a recommendation not to share before 12 weeks, because it may not work out. But then actually, when it doesn't work out, you want those people around you. Yeah. So it's a strange thing. I remember I really just wanted my mum when the IVF didn't work, in a kind of really like primal way. So we gave ourselves a month off while, you know, I had a period and everything. And then the next month, I think we sort of tried, but we were a bit like, we're going to wait to have this second round at this clinic that we'd found that was affordable.
Yeah.
Really excited about that, so we can chill a bit. And would you believe, I got pregnant that month, literally the cycle after the failed IVF.
That's my near 2 year old.
Well, anecdotally, it is.
Right, okay.
So I don't know what the stats are. I don't know whether it's something that's a really true thing, or whether it's just that when it happens to people, they obviously talk about it because it's amazing. But I must say, I spent the whole of my teens and 20s being told, don't get pregnant, you'll get pregnant at the drop of a hat, make sure you use this, make sure you use that, make sure you use this. And then all of a sudden you try and get pregnant, and it's sometimes not that easy for you. And that makes sense to me. Like, maybe your body just has been told for so long not to do the thing that it naturally does, that then it's not able to do it. So I wonder whether something about the IVF process that's, you know, sort of mimicking pregnancy, maybe that helped. I don't know. Or maybe the relaxation. I don't know. The giving up.
So you now have Nancy, mm-hmm. who's going to be 2 in April.
Yeah.
And you're pregnant again.
Yes.
18 and a half weeks.
Yeah.
That was also natural.
Yeah.
So I guess if you could say one thing to the listeners that, you know, many people will be listening. We've covered conceiving, IVF. We've covered two very different miscarriages. Mm. Pregnancy loss after an IVF attempt, and then naturally conceived. There's a lot in here. But for people that may be listening to this and have been trying or have just had a miscarriage, is there advice that you were given? What advice can you give? Is there any advice that you can give, because everyone's so different? I don't know.
For me, it made me feel positive to feel I was on my own road. Right. And that thing of not comparing myself to other people and not adding that pressure in, as well as all the other pressures. I can't understand the kind of medicine around why it's now been very, you know, this last pregnancy was really straightforward for me. I did actually have a cheeky miscarriage in between Nancy and this one. I was so surprised I was pregnant. You know, she was only 9 months old. And then it was a very, very soon afterwards I started bleeding. But what I would say is if you have had miscarriages and you are now pregnant, it's really worth looking at like the NICE guidelines and things like that, because I looked into this new guideline about progesterone. And when I started having spotting with this current pregnancy, I went to the early pregnancy unit and they did give me progesterone.
You suggested it, didn't you?
I asked for it, yeah, because
it's quite new on the NICE guidelines.
Yeah, they've said they want anybody who's had one miscarriage before, if they experience bleeding in early pregnancy, then it can be beneficial for them to take progesterone. And some of the hospitals aren't doing it yet, but guys in St. Thomas's were brilliant and they said, listen, we're not doing it as kind of rote now, but because you've mentioned it and because you are one of those people, we're really keen to follow the NICE guidelines. So whether that's helped with this pregnancy, I don't know. I can't tell.
How has pregnancy been for you after suffering so many losses? How has it affected you being pregnant? Has it made you incredibly nervous? Mm. Are those first 12 weeks excruciating, or does it carry on because you are constant? I don't know.
I think it's both. I think I have massively enjoyed loads of pregnancy because I'm so delighted to be pregnant, like so buzzing about it. So that's one thing, and that's the positive thing. The other side of it is the knicker watching is insane. I'm sure it is for anyone who's pregnant, but I have spotting when I was pregnant with Nancy, and with this one I've had bleeding where I've had to go to the hospital to check it out and everything. And so you just are completely obsessed with every twinge, every pain, every all of that. And so trying to find ways to kind of be mindful about that has been really, really hard. And I do struggle. I struggle with that now. Like I still am panicking. As soon as something goes slightly wrong, I think, oh my God, this is it. This is the end. This is, yeah. And I start to kind of envisage the worst situation. Whereas maybe if you haven't had one, you don't expect it so much.
And people don't know Alice, and you may have got a good gauge about the kind of person, she's the best person ever, but she's also one of the most optimistic, relaxed people that I know. So for you to have this is very uncharacteristic, isn't it?
Totally. I think that's the massive thing about it. Like, it has such a consuming... Well, when you're pregnant, you're so consumed with it anyway, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so sides of me that I didn't know were there, bits of anxiety. And I think it's so normal to be anxious about a pregnancy when you've had a pregnancy loss. I just think, of course, it makes complete sense. You don't trust your body in the way that you might trust your body if it's been straightforward from the beginning. You just constantly think maybe there's going to be something scuppered. But having said that, once I had the early scan and there was a heartbeat, that was a massive reassurance. Mm. I then had obviously the 12-week scan, and again it was a massive reassurance. And then even when I've had little complications of bits of bleeding, it's so incredibly lucky that we have day assessment units and early pregnancy units that we can just turn up at. Yeah. They do all the tests. It's incredible. And then, you know, on the whole, once you've got to a certain point, it's incredibly rare for you to lose the baby. And so you start to feel more confident and you start to enjoy the side of it that's just great. I must say, like, being pregnant when you've had miscarriage, like, every time you feel sick or tired or stuff, you're like, yes, love it, because you feel like that's telling you that you're still pregnant.
Lastly, before I let you go back to Nancy, for any partners or friends who are listening to this, is there any advice you would give to them with how one can support somebody that is suffering a loss or trying to conceive and not?
I think something I found really comforting with my husband was that he was genuinely interested in the whole process, or at least he humoured me and would like look into, you know, how the whole fertility stuff worked. Really, really like watched, you know, documentaries with me, listened to podcasts with me. He was just really, really good at kind of embracing what was consuming me at that time, because otherwise you can get in a bit of a rabbit hole by yourself. So I think talking and asking, and I think post miscarriage, just asking how people are a few weeks down the line, a few months down the line, like, how are you feeling? Because obviously when you lose a pregnancy, you had a due date kind of thing. So there's a whole period up to there where you think, I would have been at this stage or I would have been at that stage. So just checking, I think just checking in, and classic listening, you know, when somebody wants to talk. And I think as well, like, after the failed IVF, I had some therapy that the NHS provided, and that was brilliant, because they said this comment that I just thought was so fantastic, that what had happened was that my surety in the world had been rocked or whatever. And I think things like pregnancy, where you just expect it to be a right, you know, she said once that happens, then other things start to feel less sure. And once she said that, it just made so much sense, and I felt so comforted by that. So talking to people, if you need to get help, get help. I think, yeah, I found the support of friends and family were the best tonic, and really the thing that got me through the whole thing.
Thank you, Alice, for talking. Such a pleasure. Good luck on this pregnancy. You're nearly halfway, babe.
Yeah, I know. I love it. I love being pregnant. I absolutely love it.
Thanks, babe.
Thanks.
Thank you so much to Tejal and Alice for talking to us on this special episode about miscarriage and pregnancy loss. I hope you found that helpful, and we will be putting some of those charities mentioned in the show notes. Thank you for listening and sending you all my love.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.